Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Cohen, author of the new book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohen is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, who covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, A Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohen.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
And happy Thanksgiving to you as well, Bill.
And to you.
And the New York Times this week had a front page article, As Layoffs Rise, Stock Buybacks Consume Cash. And this very detailed article really explains to me what seems to be an absolute criminal state in corporate America, given the broader economy with so much unemployment, that what's happening here is that the U.S. corporations are sitting on record amounts of cash, and rather than reinvest that cash in new equipment and machinery and R&D and employing people, they're buying back their stock so that the top executives can look good as the stock price goes up because there's less stock around. They therefore can reward themselves enormous bonuses, which invariably take place at the expense of workers who they lay off.
It's a very, very distressing phenomenon that was described by Nelson Schwartz on the front page of the Times this week. You know, and the examples that he used were quite telling. I mean, whether it was Campbell's Soup, which on June 23rd bought back $1 billion in stock, and then 5 days later said it would lay off 770 employees, or Pfizer that bought back an additional $5 billion worth of stock on top of $4 billion already, and then laid off employees. I mean, again, the idea that there's so many reasons why this is offensive. I mean, it's offensive, number one, just as a pure corporate finance matter, because a lot of these companies tended to buy back the stock at high levels, high prices, and then the stock fell dramatically. And so that money that they spent buying the stock, is basically wasted money. I mean, for instance, a company, that we all know well, Netflix has been busy buying back its stock, as the stock was going up to close to $300 a share, and now it's, in the $60 or $70 range. And so, what does that mean? So that is, number one, a huge waste of corporate assets. And number two, to turn around and lay off people when you could have used that money to, pay their salaries or expand what their work day or the things that they do day to day, or build new plant and equipment, as you said, it sends such a poor message. It must devastate morale, I would think, at these companies. And then the topper of all is that by buying back the stock, they reduce the denominator, on their earnings per share because there are fewer shares out. So it looks like their earnings per share go up, assuming their profitability stays the same, because they have a smaller denominator in terms of number of shares, which means that many of these corporate executives get rewarded by the boards of directors for higher earnings per share numbers, and it's all, manipulated. So they get higher bonuses, employees get laid off, and it's a total waste of corporate assets because, in this choppy stock market environment, the stocks tend to go down after these purchases rather than up.
So, William Cohen, are we talking about a hollowing out of corporate America here? This, you could describe this as the extraction concentration model, where wealth is extracted from within at the expense of the workers, and the wealth is then concentrated at the top, which is, of course, very much the narrative that's out there on the streets with the Occupy movement. It's the 99% versus the 1%, where the 1%, Robin Hood in reverse, if you will.
Well, Ian, I mean, this is a very fair point. I mean, I happened a few weeks ago to be catching up with former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who I had written about extensively in my Goldman Sachs book, And he was pointing out to me that when he was Treasury Secretary, he commissioned a study to analyze the discrepancy between rich and poor in this country. And he had to go back. They produced the study for him, and the results were that it was, you know, more than 100 years earlier during the Gilded Age when he found the wealth discrepancy to be this extensive between either CEOs and their workers or just rich and poor in generally. And this is an example of, you know, the Nelson Schwartz story is an example of how this happens, because corporate assets are frankly wasted buying back stock that loses value in order for top executives who basically can't get the job done any other way, you know, use an accounting gimmick to increase earnings per share and to get paid higher bonuses while the employees get, you know, laid off or paid less. It's really you know, deeply offensive, and you know, I only wish, frankly, that the Occupy Wall Street crowd really understood this and internalized this kind of behavior on Wall Street or on Wall Street or in corporate America, so that they could articulate, you know, why they're offended, as opposed to just sort of this amorphous blithering about 99 versus 1. I think they'd be more effective if they could point to examples like this where they are, you know, truly offended and why. It would be much more effective, but that's just, you know, my personal opinion.
Well, again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, author of the new book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohen's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. The point of our discussion here, Bill, is that this is not an isolated thing in corporate America, that what the New York Times revealed this week. This is pervasive, and these are the Fortune 500 companies. So your point about Occupy Wall Street people, you know, the people that they hopefully will influence, and apparently they're in the polls indicate that they're much more popular than the Tea Party is. So maybe they are, in fact, influencing. I think it's Main Street America that needs to get this message, don't you think?
Well, I think Main Street America also needs to get this message, because they're the people that vote, and they are able to corral candidates that they, you know, that they want to vote for. I think, you know, one of the problems with Occupy Wall Street is they don't seem to want to plug into the political process, or at least not yet, anyway. And I think, again, that would be a very effective thing for them to try to do. But I think that you know, we've been hearing now for several years about the, you know, substantial sums, often put at something like $2 trillion of cash that sits on the balance sheets of corporate America, that they're just, you know, using in instances like this to buy back stock, or just sitting there collecting, you know, close to zero in interest, instead of investing that money in new plant and equipment. And, you know, the reasons we keep hearing for why they're just sitting on this cash is sort of the uncertainty in Washington, whether it's fiscal irresponsibility, another example of which we saw this past week with the super committee sort of floundering, you know, several weeks even before their appointed deadline. It seemed like, you know, it was preordained that they weren't going to get anything done. That kind of ongoing fiscal responsibility, not knowing what's going to happen with taxes, not knowing what's going to happen with sort of the European debt crisis and the European economies, all of these factors contribute to decisions by corporate executives just to sort of sit tight with this cash instead of investing it in hiring, you know, new employees and building new plants. And, you know, one consequence of that is this wasteful use of buying back their stock, which, you know, frankly, as a corporate finance matter, rarely proves out well. And I don't know, you know, aside from being able to goose the earnings per share calculation to help their own, you know, pay and compensation packages, you know, shouldn't be done. It just doesn't. It isn't effective. It historically has not proven effective, and we're again in a time period where it's not proving effective. This kind of money should be invested in new plant and equipment, in hiring new workers. We have got to get America back working again, and corporate America is really one of the keys to it.
So, William Cohen, you just mentioned the economic problems in Europe with the Eurozone, and I talked to a lot of economists who suggest that the analogy that was given was that the hurricane has come ashore, that there's some serious shoes are going to drop, and that perhaps, well, the question I raised was, does that therefore mean that President Obama's re-election chances are in the hands of Angela Merkel, in as much as if the European leaders don't get their act together, and so far they have failed to do so, the euro crash will bring back a double dip recession over here, or even something worse. Would that be your analysis too?
Well, certainly we're in that very tenuous period of time where we continue to hope that the Europeans get their act together, because we don't want to think about the consequences if they don't. And clearly, it could be something that affects the election campaign season beginning very shortly in 2012. Personally, I think that rather than his President Obama's re-election being sort of in the hands of Angela Merkel, I fear that it's in the hands of this do-nothing Congress that we have, because unfortunately, we don't live in a monarchy or where that we have a prime minister. We have a president who really can't. It's amazing. One thinks about how powerful the president of the United States is, but he really can't do a whole lot if he doesn't have the cooperation of Congress. And this Congress has been determined to pretty much thwart him since the 2010 elections. So for the last year plus, and he's proposed, I think, this very sound jobs program, which is seems moribund. Nothing was done last week with the super committee. Now there'll be $1.2 trillion of cuts that kick in 2013 after the election. So I'm afraid that it'll be the economy that will take him down if it does, because that's what people vote for, and it seems to be that the strategy of the obstreperous Republican Congress is to prevent anything that actually might help the American people from happening, all at the, with the hope of driving Obama from office. And that seems to be very, very, very cynical and very distressing for the people in this country who want to get back to work.
Well, William Cohen, clearly the president, I think, will run against the do-nothing Congress, borrowing from Harry Truman's surprise come-from-behind win. But his opponent is more and more likely to be Mitt Romney, I think. And I'm interested in your take on the article that was in the New York Magazine a month or so ago about the Romney economy, which really did a thorough piece of work looking into the history of Bain Capital, Romney's company, and what they did and how he got so rich to become a kind of one of the one percenters. The point about that article, what I took away from it was that in many ways it looks like Mitt Romney sort of established this model that we're talking about here from the New York Times report this week, the extraction concentration model, where you extract wealth out of companies and concentrate it in the hands of those that pulled off these deals.
Well, he certainly is. Although it's slightly different, because we're talking about big corporate stock buybacks in the Nelson Schwartz article versus this whole evolution of leveraged buyouts, private equity deals, which has really been going on for probably the last 35 years, which believe it or not, probably predated Mitt Romney, but certainly Mitt, when he was at Bain Consulting, started Bain Capital and really took advantage of it and made himself incredibly wealthy. But he's not alone in that regard. Many of the pioneers in private equity, including Teddy Forsman, who just passed away on Sunday, and Henry Kravis, who was in the news today for spending $7 billion to buy an oil services company in his hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I mean, this is a way of wealth creation and what I call alchemy that is really quite extraordinary. I have to say, it's quite a brilliant insight in the way for very few people to make a tremendous amount of money, borrowing money from other people to do it. And unfortunately, as was pointed out in that New York Magazine article and his other articles about the kinds of deals that Mitt Romney did when he was at Bain Capital, a lot of the people who work at these companies suffer, i.e. either their pay gets cut or their jobs get lost, they get downsized, in order to make it possible for people like Mitt Romney to make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in wealth. And again, it's perfectly legal. It's very clever. It definitely widens the gap between rich and poor. Some people would argue that it makes American companies more competitive and by rationalizing them and forcing them to become more productive. And, you know, there is some truth to that. But the real beneficiaries are the private equity firms that do these kinds of deals and use the financial alchemy to make them happen. And if people have to get fired or laid off in the process, well, that's just one cost of doing business that they're more than willing to engage in to, you know, make millions and millions and millions of dollars for themselves and the people who invest in these funds.
But what happens, though, in these leveraged buyouts, from what that article indicates and what I understand, is that it's a part of what I referred to earlier as the hollowing out of corporate America, where these companies, their wealth is stripped, they're downsized, a lot of workers are laid off, and the people that are left managing this company, the profits they have to work so hard to make, all go to pay off the banks.
Well, that again, that's part of the alchemy of these leveraged buyouts. They borrow money, pledging the assets of the company that they're buying, and then they take the cash flow of the company and use it to pay down the debt, increasing the equity value, which goes to the Bain Capitals of the world and their investors. Again, it's a perfectly legal. Maybe it shouldn't be. It's certainly enabled by, the benefits are enabled by a corporate tax policy, which allows for the tax deductibility of interest payments on debt, which is why debt is the preferred capital of choice to use in these instances. So, I mean, you know, and I'm sure that was done as an extent of huge amount of lobbying. And another low piece of low-hanging fruit that remains out there is that these people who work at these private equity firms, they get a combination of management fees and upside on the investments, so-called 2 and 20. They get 2% fees and 20% of the upside. Well, you know, those 2% fees and that 20% of the upside is taxed at capital gains rates. So the secretaries who work there often pay, who get ordinary income, pay higher tax rates than these, you know, 100 millionaires and billionaires who work there, working this corporate alchemy. They pay a lower tax rate. And when Obama has tried to fix that in the tax code, they get up in arms and they go screaming and calling up their congressmen and calling up everybody they can to think of to prevent it from happening. And yet it's such an obvious repair that needs to happen, an inequity that needs to happen in the tax code, that I'm amazed that they've been able to withstand it. And again, this is something that if Occupy Wall Street really understood the way this worked, could make a big stink about this and get it, and I'd probably be very effective at getting it changed. But, well, you know, I'm not sure they understand that this is going on.
Well, hopefully this program will help educate a lot of people about what's really happening. And I thank you so much for joining us here today, William Cohan.
My pleasure, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care. Again, I've been speaking with William Cohan, author of the new book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan is a contributing editor at Fortune magazine, a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. He also wrote House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, which details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for a decade and a half, both at Laissez Faire and J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Laissez Faire and Company. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about things we have to be thankful for in terms of new social movements on Thanksgiving.
Nobody knows what to do. we need.